Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who has offered transapical mitral valve repair procedures for more than 3 years and currently serves as a trial site for over 50 clinical trials. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Research from the Journal of Adolescent Health finds that 1 in 3 children has tried alcohol by the age of 8. That number increases to 2 out of 3 by the age of 12. The Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board is taking proactive measures to help parents educate children about underage drinking. The program, called Know When, Know How, targets youth, really their parents, between the age of 8 and 12 years old and helps parents to address the awkwardness of a conversation about alcohol. Joining us to discuss underage drinking and the campaign that is aimed at the parents of children between 8 and 12 is Ellen D. Domenico, who is Acting Deputy Secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Secretary D. Domenico, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, Elizabeth Brassel, who is Director of Communications for the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity to have the conversation.
If you have a question or a comment, like to join in, how to reduce underage drinking, maybe talk about the conversations you've had with your own children, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Elizabeth Brassel, let's talk a little bit about the thinking behind this Know When, Know How campaign.
Sure. So it's been about 10 years since the PLCB looked at developing a statewide alcohol education advertising campaign. And when we started to think about where we wanted to go with the next campaign, we looked at a lot of change that's happened over the last 10 years. Social norms have really changed. There's you know, sort of a regular acceptance of alcohol in everyday life and social settings. There's almost a proliferation of drinking as a part of everyday life, even heavy drinking. And so today's parents are just, it's a bigger part of their lives than it was maybe 10 years ago. And on top of that, obviously, technology has changed. Our campaign 10 years ago had no social media elements whatsoever because social was still too new. But as we all know, you know, Facebook, Twitter, social media is a place where both parents and their kids are going to for engagement on a very regular basis. And it's also a place that parents are going to seek input and guidance on parenting techniques. Something else that's really changed over the last 10 years in Pennsylvania is the beverage alcohol marketplace. It continues to evolve. The numbers of breweries and wineries and distilleries across the state has exploded in recent years. And due to recent changes over the last couple of years in the law, you know, now, as Pennsylvanians know, you can get wine and beer in hundreds of grocery stores across the state. So all of this sort of combined, you know, not passing judgment on any of these changes. It's today's reality. But we're acknowledging that today's children are forming relationships and perceptions of alcohol earlier than they did 10 years ago. You know, today's reality is that kids are seeing the Bordeaux in the grocery store before they're seeing the broccoli, oftentimes. So all of this spoke to the need to go a little younger. Our previous campaign was focused on young adults, college-age students, and kind of communicated the negative impacts of binge drinking. So we really decided we had to go younger. We weren't quite sure how young we wanted to go, and that's why we put a lot of research behind this campaign. We started off with a statewide survey of about 500 Pennsylvania parents. We focused that up with 8 focus groups across the state. We really wanted to understand what real Pennsylvania parents' perceptions of underage drinking were and what their own attitudes and relationships with alcohol were. So this is all, it's a research-based education and prevention campaign, and it just really recognizes the need to start having conversations earlier than parents perhaps thought necessary, and to continue the conversations as the children grow and develop and face new challenges.
That research, I'm interested in that. What did it find, those 500 people that you surveyed?
Sure. So there were a few key takeaways. First of all, 94% of the parents we surveyed think that it's their job, it's their responsibility to talk to their kids about alcohol. But only about a third of them had ever seen or read or heard of any information on how to do it. So they know it's their job, they're just not really sure where to start. We also learned that about 7 in 10 Pennsylvania parents keep alcohol in their homes and acknowledge that it's not secured. And that's important because 85% of underage drinkers get their alcohol from their own home or from the home of a parent. So again, you know, this is not about passing judgment. It's just sort of acknowledging today's reality and getting parents to think of how the alcohol is in their home, how accessible it is. You know, do we need to think about securing it a little bit earlier? So those were a few of the key findings. It was really interesting to sit through the focus groups and have conversations with the parents and see the light bulbs go off. You know, we talked about some of the statistics that you mentioned. The 1 in 3 kids by the age of 8 has tried alcohol. There's another statistic that sort of commingles with that and can set the stage for some pretty scary thoughts. Children who have tried alcohol by the age of 13 are 4 times more likely to become reliant on alcohol or alcohol abusers later in life. So, you know, these are kind of scary statistics, but there's good news. And the good news is this age group, this 8 to 11 or 8 to 12 years old, it's also the time frame when kids are most receptive to parents' feedback.
All right, let me follow up on that a little bit. Because you're not really aiming the campaign at the children themselves, but at the parents. Why?
Correct. Because you know, through the research, we found that parents know this is their job. When we first thought about the campaign, we thought, you know, should we have an education element? Should we be talking to scout leaders, school coaches, school teachers? And the resounding feedback was parents think this is their job. It's their job to have this conversation. And they're really the most suited to have the conversation. What we also found in through the survey and through the focus groups is every family situation is unique. And there are so many learning opportunity moments that can vary by family style, by family history, by interests of the children. The parents are really the best position to know how to start having these conversations, what the right moments are, and how to approach them. What we found was that, you know, families who have histories of alcoholism or alcohol abuse, they're already starting these conversations far earlier. We talked to a mother who as early as 3 had started talking with her daughter about alcohol because it was a necessity. There was an alcoholic in the home. And so it was something that she had to address and talk about with her daughter very early. Families that abstain from alcohol use, you know, they were the ones that, you know, I don't really need to have this conversation. Maybe middle school, maybe high school. But the reality is that the kids are being exposed to this kind of thing earlier and earlier.
See, that's interesting that you say that where there is a home where someone who abuses alcohol, that they have the conversation earlier, because Secretary DiDomenico, you know, one thing that we do know from the research, and this has been well researched over the years, is that children where there is a parent or there is someone in the home who drinks or where alcohol is readily available, that child is more likely to grow up and drink as well, right?
That's correct. And I think it's from a couple of different perspectives. I mean, and I think all of this campaign can really start to look at a number of those factors. I mean, first of all, we do know that all substance use is related to predispositions within the family, genetics, hereditary kinds of conditions and those things. But we also know that it's about the exposure and the attitudes and the early starts and a variety of different factors that we can have an impact on. And so either way, the campaign is really critical. So for those children who unfortunately have the predisposition because of the family dynamics, it doesn't mean that they have to go down a negative path. So there is the ability to really help kids make better decisions, think about the consequences, think about the likelihood that they could be exposed to those things. And you know, if they never start, or if they find themselves being able to look for other supports earlier on, they don't need to go down a fully negative path. So that in and of itself, the campaign can really be important in terms of family members talking early on.
But there's mixed messages there.
Sure.
Okay, let's use this Sunday, for example. This Sunday, Super Bowl. I'm wearing my Eagles garb today because I'm a huge Eagles fan. There will be a lot of people who will have Super Bowl parties. There will be a lot of drinking going
on.
The kids, what they're going to see is that mom and dad or other people, other adults at the party are drinking alcohol and having a good time. And they may see that more than just at a Super Bowl party. They may see that on a regular basis, that for the parents to have a good time, there always is alcohol. So doesn't that send a mixed message to the kids that
Absolutely.
The parent who drinks is going to come back and say, oh, I do it, but you shouldn't because it's a bad thing?
And I think the mixed message is absolutely out there. But again, I think the message that we want to give through things like this campaign and through other opportunities for children to have the education is really that, one, you don't have to have alcohol to have a good time. There are some other ways. Not everyone who uses alcohol ends up having a good outcome as a result of that for a variety of reasons. And we don't always know that, of who will have negative consequences and who will not. And we also know that for some kids, the not only the family environment, but the predispositions will make it very likely that should they begin to use, they will end up in a not great position afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of that's about the campaign, talking about it early, helping kids understand, helping kids make good choices, helping them see the consequences.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, that's something else that we saw in the research when we were talking to the parents, is that parents of kids who are intending to do the right thing, they're really having trouble reconciling their own behavior and their own use of alcohol with what they're supposed to be teaching their kids. They don't want to be hypocrites. But at the same time, I mentioned the proliferation of drinking and heavy drinking as a social norm, that the whole wine mom mentality is new in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And, the social media memes that sort of make it joke about it. And, parents feel that alcohol is perhaps even a necessary way to deal with parenting challenges
life. We've actually heard those stories about a glass of alcohol mm-hmm. or a glass of wine a day actually helps you health-wise. So
right.
Didn't mean rub good.
Yeah, no. So parents said, how am I supposed to start this conversation? I am that mom that goes home and has the glass of wine on a Friday night, and my kids are seeing me do it. So how do I tell them it's not appropriate? And so the knowwhennowhow.org is the campaign website, and that's where there's a ton of information on there. There's a ton of information on the health effects of alcohol. But additionally, there's tips and scenarios on how parents can actually start this conversation and how you can talk about good modeling behavior, be a good model, but then talk about what you're doing. And, if mom and dad are going out to dinner and dad's going to have a cocktail or two, then mom doesn't have one, or mom has one and stops, and mom's the one that drives home. And having that conversation with the kids, explaining that, some kids are really into the science of things and how things work. And for those kids, a lot of times it works to get into that science stuff and what the impacts on the brain and nerve cell damage and that kind of thing. And it's different for kids because those parts of the body are still developing versus adults where, their bodies are better able to handle the substance.
So, Karina, let's talk a little bit about that, because not only is this an age group that you can get ahead of, when they typically would start drinking a little bit heavier, but there are health reasons for kids this age not to start drinking in the first place
right.
as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So, pieces of what we know are that the younger a child starts, the more likely it is that they will have some more significant issues with alcohol use. I mean, so that in and of itself is something really important for parents to understand, particularly parents who may say, well, I'll let them drink at home because that's better than having them drink out in
the
community.
That's a whole other campaign, isn't it?
That is a whole other campaign.
Yeah.
But again, it's part of, I think, what we have to help parents to understand why that isn't the answer. you know, that in and of itself isn't the way to deal with this, is let's have them drink at home. That because there are still physical health issues for kids who start to drink and start to drink more heavily at a younger age. So I think that that's a piece of what we have to help kids understand, is that while adults do drink, and it is a part of the social norms of the area where we live, that it's really important that for them it may not be... the same effects will be exacerbated for younger kids. You know, it's sort of like, why do we say kids can't drive cars till they're 16? You know, there are things that are different for younger folks, and things that we have to help them understand why it's a good decision to not do that at an earlier age.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Today is part of WITF's Transforming Health Project. For more on underage drinking, drinking overall, and we'll be talking about the World Cancer Day later in the program. So there are a lot of topics that can be addressed. Check out WITF's Transforming Health, from policy to personal choices. We're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. During this portion of the program, we're talking about a new campaign by the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. It is called Know When, Know How. It is aimed at parents who have children between the ages of 8 and 12 years old, talking to them about alcohol use and how to keep them from start drinking in the first place. Our guest, Ellen DiDomenico, Acting Deputy Secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Program, and Elizabeth Brussell, who is Director of Communications for the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. If you have a question or comment, like to join our conversation, 1-800-729-7533. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Elizabeth, I have to admit that as I was researching today's topic, I thought about my own experience, and that my parents probably did not have the drinking conversation with me until after I had that first beer. And I don't know whether that's typical or not, but it seems as though, number one, you kind of touched on this earlier, number one, that a lot of parents don't think about this age group, kids this young, needing to have that conversation, because let's face it, most 8 to 12-year-olds aren't going out and getting drunk very often or drinking a lot. Granted, we've seen the statistics between the age of 8, that 1 in 3 has tried alcohol. It doesn't mean that they're binge drinking or anything like that. But a couple questions here. Why this age? I mean, what do you want to say to these parents about why it's important to hit this age group? And why is it difficult for parents to have this conversation?
Sure. So as far as, you know, how to start the conversation. One of the keys of this campaign is that it doesn't have to be one big intimidating talk. This isn't something that you have to plan and dread. And in fact, we encourage that it's not. It's about starting early to set a really solid foundation. And that can be really important and impactful. And I can say just from my own experience, Ellen heard me tell this story last week when we were talking about the campaign at a school in Elizabethtown. I have two kids. My oldest is 8. So developing this campaign has been a really interesting experience for me. I was right there with a lot of the parents that we surveyed. You know, I know it's my job to have this conversation with my kids, but I thought, eight feels a little early. And, you know, as I'm having my glass of Chardonnay on a Friday night, like, I'm kind of struggling to figure out how to have this conversation. So it's been really eye-opening to see how, you know, we can turn everyday moments, age-appropriate moments, into conversation starters. So a couple of months ago, we were reading Harry Potter. Harry Potter is my 8-year-old's, you know, greatest obsession now. And we got to the part towards the end of book one where Quirrell gets Hagrid drunk to learn the secret of sneaking past Fluffy, the three-headed dog. And I kind of sat there and went, oh my gosh, I certainly wasn't expecting a drunken character in my evening self-selected reading, right?
I wouldn't have expected that either.
But no. There it was. I'm sitting on the bed with my 8-year-old, and thanks to J.K. Rowling, the door was open. And so we put the book down, and I asked him if he knew what drunk meant. And, you know, it was a really simple conversation. It was maybe 2 minutes. You know, I learned that he knows that drunk is, you know, adults can start to act a little funny if they've had too much beer and wine.
Or a lot.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, at his age, at 8, he still thinks it's wildly unattractive to him and his friends. So, you know, kind of got a baseline for where he is, and it gave me the confidence to look for those kinds of moments moving forward. We talked a little bit at the holidays about the difference between, you know, the adult celebratory cocktails and the kid wine that's at the table. And you mentioned the Eagles game on Saturday. My son this morning said, you know, are you going to talk about the Eagles? And I said, well, you know how last night you were looking at the green drinks that the party host was thinking of making and how we talked about those were adult drinks? Well, maybe I can find a kid drink that's appropriate. So
that's great.
It is once you're more comfortable with it, and this campaign is all about providing the information, the tools, and the confidence that parents need to start having these meaningful conversations. Once you start looking at it as being able to happen in little snippets over time, it really is much more accessible. And that's what we heard from the parents that we've talked to in focus groups.
And Secretary, there are more than enough opportunities if you look, because as the two of you have said, it is everywhere on television, even in, you know, I think that would surprise a lot of people not familiar with the Harry Potter stories, that in a story like that, that is for kids for the most part, although many, many adults read it as well, that there would be an opportunity, but it is everywhere. So there are many, many opportunities for parents to have this conversation linked to whatever the kid is seeing.
And I think that's the important piece of this campaign, is really thinking about the balance in all of that. You know, as you're pointing out, kids are seeing this everywhere. I mean, so if we think that somehow at 8 or 9 or 10 years old, they have not yet been exposed to alcohol and therefore we don't want to have the conversation, you know, we're not really looking at what's happening in the, you know, television, the, you know, social media, all of those things. So, you know, we really do have to give kids the opportunity to have the balance there. You know, what's the other information that the commercials for the Super Bowl don't provide? You know, what's the balance of information that kids should have? What's the information that that they may not get if we expect that they're only going to hear about this in a positive way some other place? Because that's not the case. They're hearing some negative information. They're hearing some encouragement of alcohol use in a way that we have to use parents as the first and best teachers to provide that balance.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some phone calls. Bob is in Chambersburg. Bob, you're on here.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate the conversation, but I think one thing is really critical is that not all parents are even present in these households to have these conversations. And it's children that are often left alone or feel disconnected to loved ones or don't even feel loved have these bigger issues. And then you look further on and look at adverse childhood experiences, which I'm sure our speaker knows about. You put households that have 4, 5, or 6 check marks in there, you will see more prevalence of young people in this age group that will be experimenting with alcohol. And lifelong, I think was earlier referenced, these folks turn into oftentimes drug abusers, and there are health issues related to all that. So this conversation today is very, very important, but it's important to engage the families and get intervention, as was just discussed earlier.
Hey, Bob, thank you very much for your call. And he does bring up an excellent point in that, you know, we're talking about parents having this conversation with their children. But the reality is, just as Bob described, there are many children who may have a single parent in the home that is working on a regular basis, is not having not just this conversation, but many other conversations as well. And something else he touched on is that the statistics show that many kids, I think most kids, that first drink or the first time they get drunk or that first time they binge drink is at another person's house, at a friend's house, when the parents aren't at home. So let's address these things. I mean, if you're not, if the child is not going to get the information from the parents, where else can they get it?
And I think that, you know, again, this is one piece of the puzzle, you know, one piece of what we need to be doing in terms of good prevention. You know, most school districts do a pretty good job at trying to do education. We'd certainly be encouraging them to think about it from a health perspective, or oftentimes it's done in a science class or those kinds of things. But to really think about the good curriculums that are out there from a prevention perspective that helps kids get that information from a secondary source. So, you know, parents being first and best, but, you know, lots of other places. You know, increasing social media information around this, increasing the school district's participation in providing this education. And then, as the caller talked about, you know, those kids that have other adverse things going on in their lives, thinking about where the role is of other social services in terms of making sure this is a piece of the intervention that happens for those young folks, too.
And, Elizabeth, what about, you know, the young people who start drinking or maybe have their first drink, their first experience with alcohol at a friend's house?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there's some peer pressure there. We know that.
Absolutely.
I mean, a lot of times, whether it's trying marijuana for the first time, whether mm-hmm. it's trying alcohol for the first time, that, oh, come on, do it. Everybody does it. You know, don't be a chicken, whatever. We know that occurs.
Yeah, we do. And I think that, that sort of speaks to the importance of starting perhaps earlier than parents thought necessary. You know, I learned that my 8-year-old he's not interested right now. But if I lay that solid foundation and open the door and these conversations become a regular part of our dialogue, you know, maybe not on a daily or a weekly basis, but he starts to learn that we have these regular check-ins and the door is open and he can ask questions of his own. I think that helps to build the communication and the confidence between the parent and the child moving forward, so that, you know, when the child starts to face some of these situations, he's more comfortable bringing them to me. And one of the key campaign messages is for parents to stay involved in their children's lives, to, you know where your child's going, know who your child's friends are, get to know the parents of your children's friends, know what the activities are that they're getting involved in. The more involved you are in your child's life, or the more aware you are of who those friends are and what those groups of people are, the better position you'll be in to have the conversations.
But then going back to what Bob talked about, where there may not be two parents in the home, mm-hmm. where the parents may be working and the child is on their own a little bit more. I mean, that's a difficult situation. It's more difficult for a parent to monitor where their kids are, who they're with, when that situation is there.
Absolutely. And, you know, while this campaign is targeted to parents of 8 to 12-year-old kids, we've also put a lot of effort into making the campaign accessible to partners in prevention. So at knowwhennohow.org, you know, we have a ton of downloadable resources, printable resources. We have canned social media messages and icons. We've really been deliberative about making this campaign available to those who will embrace it and promote it and support it. So while the target market is parents, that's not to say that it's not the schools and the coaches and the scout leaders and, you know, the local businesses that can also help promote the message.
Do you think your 8-year-old has the courage to say no to a friend?
I think that he does. I think that, you know, I actually asked him, what do you think? Would you ever want to try a beer? And he kind of was like, oh, that stuff's gross, you know? So I don't think
gross?
He's there yet.
How's he know it's gross?
My children may be within that one in three statistic. I mean, you know, the reality is if there are adults sitting around and somebody gets up and there's an empty beer bottle, you know, I've seen 2-year-olds pick up empty beer bottles, and
right.
You know,
or you have the parent who says, oh, it isn't acute, we'll
or the grandparent,
yeah,
or the uncle,
Johnny,
or the friend,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
in Germany they drink all the time. Let's take a phone call from Andy in Lebanon. Andy, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for the Liquor Control Commission, since I never have the chance to meet them. There is any way, the reason is I'm calling because I'm in the wine business, I'm in the health business too, so I'm a doctor and physical therapist, but I grew up in a winery. My family owns, I'm a third generation of winemaker, and I'm from Argentina, actually, and I moved here 5 years ago, and I've been trying to learn and see a different lifestyle, and I've been living all over the world. And when I came here, one of the things that caught my attention was, and there is any way to increase the control in the quality production of the wine? The reason I say that is because every time that I go for any winery or I buy a bottle of wine, the first thing that I do, I pick up like a sample and I put it in my lab. I have a background in chemistry too, so I like to see, I like to read. It's like I would love to see the DNA of the wine when I'm drinking. And I found crazy things like a lot of sugar, a lot of tartaric acid, and sulfites. Mm. Believe it or not, the sugar is going to probably one of the reasons because make one of the major addiction, because increase your dopamine in your body. The dopamine is one of the hormones that make you feel like a fake relief for a short period of time, but you always gonna think, to make me feel again the same way, I need to go and drink whatever I'm drinking. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes increasing the control in the production will be much more or less risky, because I grew up in the wine business, I grew up in the wine industry, I saw wine probably since the day I'm born. But believe it or not, I started drinking when I was 31.
Wow. And listen, I'm gonna pass your question on.
And I have plenty of wine to drink or if I want to go there.
Hey, Andy, thank you very much. I'm going to have Elizabeth answer. As the agency that is in charge of selling wine, liquor, beer in this state that regulates it, the ingredients that go into it that Andy mm-hmm. was talking about, and you know, he's saying that it could be more addictive mm-hmm. depending on, you know, the DNA. I like the way he said that, the DNA of the wine. I mean, does the agency look at that?
You know, from the retail perspective, our Fine Wine and Good Spirits stores strive to provide a variety of quality products that appeal to the variety of Pennsylvania consumers we have. We have consumers who prefer sweet wines. We have consumers who prefer dry wines. You know, we have consumers who prefer different flavor profiles. So, you know, I think that's, we are trying to satisfy as many different tastes as possible, understanding that we have a lot of different demographics going on in Pennsylvania and a lot of different tastes.
Okay, speaking of mixed messages, there may be some who would listen to this program today and say, why is the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, the agency that sells alcoholic beverages in the state, involved in a campaign, you know, talking to parents and to try to stop kids from drinking? There would be some who would look at that and say, well, isn't that a mixed message?
Absolutely not. It's a great question. And social responsibility is one of our key tenets. We are the Commonwealth's primary retailer of wine and spirits, but we are a responsible retailer of wine and spirits. And this campaign is all about that alcohol education and social responsibility aspect. We have a Bureau of Alcohol Education within the department that exists solely to work with schools and communities and partners in prevention on reducing underage drinking, reducing dangerous drinking. Even in our stores, we do more than 1 million age verification checks every year to prevent sales to minors. And this campaign is also in our stores. We have campaign brochures in our stores. We have posters in our stores. And Fine Wine and Good Spirits is promoting the campaign on social media. So I don't think it's not an either or. In fact, the good place to be is to be a responsible retailer and acknowledge that social responsibility is one of our key challenges.
Mm-hmm. Secretary, you know, we've been talking mostly about the younger demographic. Let me kind of broaden the conversation. How prevalent is ever underage drinking in this state right now?
Well, much, much bigger than I think most people would be aware of, and much more of a concern, I think, than much of the recent media around other substance use disorders has really led us to believe. I mean, I think that part of what's happened because of the, you know, pretty serious issues that are happening around opioids and other substances is that people have really begun to lose sight of the fact that alcohol is still the primary substance that is misused in the Commonwealth, and that we have a significant number of negative consequences, both for the individual who uses and as a result of what happens with their behavior after using. So underage drinking and drinking even by adults is still a significant portion of the substance use disorder issues that we see here in Pennsylvania.
A couple things that I've found, run it by you, we only have about a minute or so left, is that binge drinking is the real problem, one of the biggest problems with underage drinking. That, and what is binge drinking? Is that like 5 or 6 in a 2-hour period, something like that?
I mean, I think people use different definitions, but I think that, the point of binge drinking is it is drinking beyond a social interaction.
It's to get drunk.
It's drinking to get drunk, and oftentimes because of the rapid way in which it's done, people drink to the point of really serious health consequences and potentially even death.
But Scott, just real quickly, I mentioned our Bureau of Alcohol Education. We actually produce a report every 2 years that has some of these statistics in it. We released one last May, and while Pennsylvania is below the national average for binge drinking, there are still 8% of 10th graders that have binge drunk, and 18% of 12th graders in Pennsylvania have binge drunk. So it's not a small number.
One thing I will say, and this is a positive of one of the stats that I did see, is that actually underage drinking peaked in 1999-2000 nationally. It's come down recently. Not to the point, I mean, we're still looking at 2/3 of,
issue.
You know, of college kids and even some high school kids. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Elizabeth Brassell. Elizabeth, that website one more time?
KnowWhenKnowHow.org.
She's Director of Communications for the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. Ellen DiDomenico, Acting Deputy Secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Sunday is World Cancer Day, a time to bring awareness to the disease that has touched every American family in some way. Pennsylvania is fourth in the nation in the number of cancer deaths, but there are advances being made in cancer research and cancer treatments. The American Society of Clinical Oncology released a report this week examining the progress that has been made. I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. John Hamack, a renowned oncologist affiliated with the University of Texas and co-executive editor of the report, Clinical Cancer Advances. Dr. John Hamack, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
Coming up this Sunday, it is World Cancer Day, February 4th. Probably a good time to look at where we are in the fight against cancer, the progress that we've made over the years in the battle against cancer. How would you describe that progress?
Well, Scott, the progress has really been spectacular over the past couple years, or even transformational would be the way I would say it. So the ASCO, or American Society of Clinical Oncology, is releasing its 13th annual Clinical Cancer Advances report ahead of World Cancer Day. And this tries to give a perspective, highlight what the most important advances are, what are the things that really affect patients' lives, help them live longer and better, and what are really the breakthroughs about whole new ways of treating cancer. And this year, the list of those major advances was quite long.
Well, let's talk about some of those advances. Cancer immunotherapies, from what I understand, are changing treatment paradigms for lung, bladder, and other cancers, and really changing the outlook for patients. In what ways?
Yeah, this really has been the single biggest change in the way cancer has been treated in recent years, along with precision-targeted agents, are immunotherapy treatments. And immunotherapy as a general term are ways of unleashing the body's own immune system to tackle the cancer. And that's very different than things like chemotherapy that really try to poison the tumor but affect people as well. The single biggest advance is one particular type of immunotherapy called CAR T-cell therapy. Now, CAR stands for chimeric antigen receptor, and this is really a radically new type of treatment. What's done are the immune cells are removed from somebody's from a patient's body, and then they're engineered in the lab with an artificial gene that helps them find the cancer better. And then they're given back to the people to fight the cancer. This is called adoptive cell immunotherapy. It's a type of gene therapy. And I would liken it, if these immune cells come out of the body like puppy dogs, they get engineered to suddenly become killer attack dogs, and they're given back to go attack the cancer. And so this has really transformed the treatment of some types of blood cancers, like leukemia, a type called ALL, in children and young adults, and a certain type of lymphoma, where the majority of patients who receive this, their cancers have completely gone into remission. These are folks who had no other options before. And the really interesting thing is you don't have to keep giving this over and over. You give this once, And because it's the body's own immune cells, they stay in the body, they grow, and the treatment actually becomes more effective over time. So this is really one example of a giant payoff of the investment in basic research over the past few decades.
Now, are these immunotherapies being used as widespread treatments nowadays?
Right. So the particular type I just mentioned, the CAR T-cell immunotherapies, are right now approved just for the blood cancers, the leukemia and the type of lymphoma. They have promising results in myeloma, but they're still being developed for the other type of cancers. Now, the more common type of immunotherapy that is now being used widely are called checkpoint inhibitors. And these are approaches that basically unmask the tumor. Tumors develop ways to hide from the immune system, and this is sort of pulling back the mask, so suddenly the immune system can recognize the tumor and start to attack it. And these checkpoint inhibitors now are widely used. In the last couple of years, they've really taken off. I'll give the example from lung cancer. That's the cancer that I treat every day. This year alone, with these drugs being used appropriately in lung cancer patients, it's estimated 250,000 years of life can be added with these drugs, which is really a monumental advance when you consider just a decade ago, all we had for lung cancer patients was essentially chemotherapy, and they only had a few percent chance of living beyond 5 years. Now that's more than one in four people are living beyond 5 years, and that's increasing rapidly. So you really see the fruits of these transformational changes in how we treat cancer.
From what you described, taking cells from the immune system of a patient, or at least using part of those immune systems to fight off the cancers or destroy the cancers, many people listening to this will say, well, that sounds like a stem cell. And we've heard so much about stem cell research. Is there any comparison?
It's a little different than stem cells, although the immune system has things that are like stem cells that can turn into other types of stem cells. These are really specifically taking immune cells and just enhancing what they do and turning them into, more effective cancer killers. Stem cells are type cells that can turn into all different types of cells in the body, and they have tremendous applications, but that's a little different than what we're doing here.
Also understand that there's new research on risk factors for cancer that include a link between alcohol and cancer.
Yeah, it's important to emphasize to your listeners, while we're very excited about these new technological breakthroughs that really can be breathtaking, but even simple lifestyle changes can have a dramatic impact on your risk of getting cancer. In fact, we estimate now that half of the cancers, 50% in the U.S., could be prevented with just some lifestyle changes. Now, one of them is avoiding excess alcohol intake, as you mentioned, maintaining a healthy body weight, increasing physical activity, and above all, avoiding tobacco. So this year, we put a spotlight on three particular lifestyle choices. One is indoor tanning beds. The UV light from that can increase the risk of melanoma by about 30%. E-cigarettes are something that really are becoming much more popular. Now, we're not sure if they directly cause cancer yet, but we know it increases the likelihood of using cancer-causing tobacco cigarettes by about threefold. And excess alcohol intake, which is estimated to cause about 6% of cancers worldwide. So these are not high-tech things. These are simple things, in addition to getting your screening tests like mammography or colonoscopy that can have a major impact on your odds of getting cancer.
You know, this may surprise a lot of people when they hear that there's a direct link between alcohol and cancer. In what way, when we're talking specifically about alcohol, does it assist in increasing the number of cancers or maybe leading to cancer?
Yeah, it can increase the odds of a few different cancers. I'll give one example, is pancreatic cancer. So excess alcohol can cause what we call pancreatitis. That's inflammation in the pancreas, and chronic users often get a chronic pancreatitis. We've learned that inflammation in any organ, and the pancreas is one example, can promote cancer. So people with heavy alcohol use are more prone to get pancreatic cancer as one example.
You know, what you described about lifestyle choices and making some changes in lifestyle, haven't we always known that if you live a healthy lifestyle, you're less likely to be obese or to suffer heart disease or to suffer cancer? So what's different? What's new?
Yeah, you know, I think what happens over time is we get better and better data about what specific interventions may or may not make a big difference. And, you know, there's commonly news that'll come out sometimes from small studies about one particular food or you know, antioxidants or vitamins and so forth. But one interesting lesson from all these studies over time, when you really take all the evidence, is that there isn't a single magic bullet in terms of a food that will do it or a pill that will do it. But it's really things that like exercise and stopping smoking over time that prove to have the biggest impact. And so the data has really become much more solid about that. There were other things that we thought might impact cancer in the past that probably don't have as much of an impact. So really we want to hone in on the things that can have a major impact, but, you know, not want to torture people so that they're afraid to get out of their car in the morning.
Dr. Hamak, I'm not looking for statistics here, but, you know, we know a lot has changed in this fight against cancer over the last 50 years, really. But today, are we seeing more cancers? Are we seeing less cancers with the knowledge that we have obtained over the years? As the population grows, is it just that we're going to continue to see more cancers, but that we know how to treat it better, prevent it, or, you know, keep people from actually dying?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, because sometimes people will say, well, it seems like cancers are going up. You know, what is it about the fight about cancer? So the first thing is that the total number of cancer survivors in the U.S. is growing significantly. In fact, right now there's currently 15 million, or 1 in 20 Americans is a cancer survivor. And by 2020, it's estimated there'll be 26 million Americans who are going to be cancer survivors. So as more people are cured of things that previously would have killed them, you know, the number of cancer survivors are growing up. And as people live longer, as they grow older, their risk of cancers go up, but our treatment effectiveness goes up as well. So without question, we're increasing the cure rates for a lot of cancers. Now, the incidence of some cancers is decreasing, but that often takes a long time to happen. So, for example, if you look at lung cancer, we know that the rates of smoking are going down a little bit in the U.S. overall, and that's impacting the rate of cancer, but it takes a long time before that has its effect. It's about a 25-year lag period. So, in other words, if you look at the rates right now, they're reflecting, you know, the amount that people were smoking in the early 90s, whereas 10 or 20 years from now, we'll start seeing bigger decreases as smoking rates fall over the past decade.
As you mentioned, we have seen a lot of progress over the years. What about disappointments? Are there some areas in cancer research and treatment of cancer where you think that maybe we should have done better, or that we would be further along than what we are?
Yeah, well, unquestionably, we would like to be curing a higher percentage of cancers once they've spread. And I'll go to the cancer I deal with most regularly, lung cancer. Now, this is the biggest killer by far. It kills more than the next three biggest killers, colon, breast, and prostate, combined. And while people are living longer, we're still not curing nearly as many as we'd like to. One of the things we learned is the chemotherapy that we're using for decades as the primary treatment. You know, we tried all different types of chemo and different combinations and so forth, And we really hit a ceiling on the amount of benefit. You know, we were not curing many more people with that. And that's why it's taken entirely new types of treatments, like you're hearing with immunotherapy or our new precision medicines, to make an impact. So sometimes you develop a method and it hits a ceiling. You only get so much benefit, and that's really where we need these new advances to come from our investment in research.
Well, investment in research means money, and one of the things that you're looking for is federal funding. Why is it so important? And, you know, I have to admit that there are probably people listening who said, well, okay, yes, we've made some progress, but we spend so much on cancer research. Have we really seen a return?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. So, first of all, it's important to point out that all the breakthroughs we're talking about couldn't have been achieved without the nation's investment in cancer research, funding the NIH and the National Cancer Institute. So fully a quarter of the ones that we discussed this year as breakthroughs were directly funded by the NCI. And the funding for cancer research in inflation-adjusted dollars has been flat. But when you talk to people, and we did a survey this past year, the vast majority, 73% of Americans, think the government should spend more to develop cancer treatments and cures, even if it means higher taxes or adding to the deficit. So I think that's something important to advocate for. Now, when you look at the amount that we spend on cancer research, here I'll talk about the National Cancer Institute. The National Cancer Institute budget is on the order of $5 billion a year. Now, that may sound like a lot, but we have some new, new airplanes that cost billions of dollars. Now, I don't want to say that we don't need airplanes or aircraft carriers or things like that, but to give an order of magnitude, we're talking a few billion dollars, which is a drop in the bucket of the more than $1 trillion that the government spends every year, and it's one that people really value in terms of the impact. 160,000 people die every year of lung cancer alone. So when you consider the number of deaths from just lung cancer, about 500,000 of cancer overall, and then look at the relatively modest investment, you know, most people are looking for a greater investment when you consider how many lives it affects.
Dr. John Haymack is co-executive editor of Clinical Cancer Advances. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Haymack is also a renowned oncologist. As you heard, lung cancer is his specialty. He's with the university, affiliated with the University of Texas. And again, this Sunday, most people will be thinking about it as Super Bowl Sunday, especially with the local team, the Philadelphia Eagles, in the Super Bowl. But it is also World Cancer Day, when there will be a lot of people who will be thinking about cancer and how their families have been touched. I mean, this is one of those things that almost every family, think about it, almost every family has been touched by cancer. And that's one of the reasons behind World Cancer Day, talking about some of the advances, some of the treatments, and some of the ways to prevent cancer overall. Coming up on Monday's program, first of all, I hope we're talking about an Eagles victory on Sunday. Yes, I am an Eagles fan. But on Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about keeping people with cognitive disorders safe and some of the ways that that is being done to keep some people with who are suffering from Alzheimer's or maybe on the autism spectrum, trying to keep them safe from harming themselves, wandering away, leaving the home, that kind of thing. That's the topic of our discussion on Monday.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.